Hi, thank you for listening to the Spotlight Report, our weekly podcast in which we sit down and speak with current academics about their life and research in lab. If you like the Spotlight Report, you can subscribe on iTunes, like our Facebook page, or find it on any common podcast app. You can also directly find the podcast on our website, which is loft.optics.arizona.edu/podcast. Please comment any questions or ideas for people you would like us to interview in the future. Additionally, if you have more feedback, feel free to email us at thespotlightreport@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. This week on the Spotlight Report, we're sitting down with Dr. Chris Summitt, who just recently got his PhD, and his dissertation topic is related to fabrication of micromirrors and their relationship to optical chips. So I'm going to let him explain it quite a bit more. So Chris, thank you for sitting down with us.
Hello, no problem.
So before we talk about the research, do you mind telling us, like, what make you to make this decision to go to the optical field?
I was crazy. I didn't know how hard it was going to be. I found optics in undergrad. I went to undergrad here.
Wow.
And yeah, I've been here a long time. Mm-hmm. And I was actually in the business college before.
Mm-hmm.
Really? I didn't know that.
No, I was doing management information systems, MIS.
Wow. Huh.
And then I thought that was kind of dumb, so then I switched over to computer engineering because I was into computers. Mm-hmm. I built computers when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And it actually wasn't what I thought it was. And then there's one critical day in Engineering 102. It's a very boring, useless class, except for this one day where you are required to go and visit three other engineering presentations, open houses,
right,
other than the one you've chosen, to make sure you're in the right one, because there's like 10 of them on this campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I just randomly chose optics because I had no idea what it was. I'd never heard of it. And I went and saw the presentation. Dr. Mike gave it with Jim Palmer, who has since passed away. We talked about the Hubble telescope and how they fixed it.
Oh.
And how cool optics was. I changed my major that day.
Wow.
And that was it. And I started taking the optics classes, and I was locked in.
Okay.
Just, I don't know, it just chanced, it just happened. And yeah. I thought it was the coolest sounding one.
Yeah.
Very high tech and way cooler than the computer engineering. It was very boring.
Yeah. They have a very good, I don't necessarily want to call it sales pitch, but I think it basically is a sales pitch for the College of Optics. You know,
Oh, really? I don't know.
I mean, when you talk to people, it's optics isn't everything.
Mm-hmm.
You get to do cutting edge work. Mm-hmm. It's, and then they can point to the Hubble, or they can point to telescopes.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's.
I've converted many people myself.
Right.
Since
right.
then, it's easy to do.
Yeah, it's almost.
If you don't
like
tell them how much math there is, then it's very easy.
Yeah, that's the key. So from that, you decided to go into optics. What made you decide to go into graduate school to pursue optics further in academics?
Oh.
Anyways?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking.
this goes naturally, it seems like.
Yeah, I had no plan. I was a horrible student in undergrad before reaching optics, and even in the beginning, I had a horrendous GPA. You can imagine I actually got kicked out of the university at one point because my GPA was so bad, 0.8. So I had failed some classes, and my undergraduate optics was not so strong. So one reason was I got to reset GPA.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know as an undergrad, some jobs kind of make GPA as part of their yeah, they won't even look at you. I know.
Right, right.
Striker is one of them. Unless you have 3 or above, they won't even look at your stuff. And I did not. I graduated with a 2.8. Mm-hmm. And also, I just wasn't ready to do work, and I didn't think I understood optics. It was rushed. The undergraduate program is very, very dense and fast and just full of stuff, and you don't have a lot of time to get into anything. You just are learning
superficially
one into the next. Yes, yeah. And you're just trying to get your homework done. I'm just trying to graduate, and so you don't really get to get that deep feeling, which is fine. You can go in industry and do that, and you really learn what you need on the job. But I feel like I would like to know more. Also, I don't want a job yet. Let's prolong this a little bit. So I just applied, and it's the only place I applied to. I studied the GRE the night before, and, you know, I got a killer letter of recommendation, and it got me in.
Huh.
It just happened.
Okay, so cool. I think that I'd like to talk about this more definitely later on, but one of the take-home things I'm getting from this, and this was kind of similar to my motivation going into the graduate colleges, you know, I was interested in optics, and I felt like I didn't get a deep understanding of topics. So I applied to grad school, but I wasn't necessarily going into it thinking that this specific project is really something that captures my interest, and that's why I want to go and pursue it, which sounds similar to you. But we can get into this later. I think it's an important topic, especially for students considering graduate school. But
So go back to your research. Why are you doing this kind of research? It's is this something also like things go naturally? Okay, I got this research and I do
My whole life is like this, actually. It just rolls by without any kind of planning, and just whatever comes by, it just happens.
Wow,
no, I did not have a sense of what I wanted to do. My research that I finished with is not what I started with.
Okay.
I began in another research group.
Okay.
I did a master's under Matt Kapinski. Medical imaging, but in this for the Center for Gamma Ray Imaging.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually was doing simulations of positron emission tomography. Totally different stuff. I'll talk about that later. But so what I graduated with, my topic that we're going to talk about today, was an initial project by Intel.
Mm-hmm.
Intel wanted to figure out how to do something. They didn't know. They tried it and they couldn't, so they paid the university to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And when I joined my research group with Dr. Takashima, that was the only funded project. So that's the one I did.
Okay.
I had no idea what it was. I didn't know anything about photonics at all, or lithography, or any of these things. I had no formal training. But that's the one that was funded. That's the one I did.
That's the one you get on, yeah. And that's kind of a common story amongst graduate students. It ends up that being funded and having money is somewhat important. Who would have guessed? But so can you give us a real superficial explanation before we dive into it of what your research was?
Okay, so I'm making a path towards what's called an optical interconnect. Basically, in the computers, we have ways of communicating between main parts of the computer. You can imagine the motherboard, and you want to communicate between the RAM, between the hard drive, between the processor. The big pieces, they need a bridge to go between themselves. That bridge is called an interconnect. It's like an optical road or electrical road, really, what it is now. We use electrical connections called electrical interconnects to get from one big part to the next. And as we continue to get better and better computers, if we want to get better and better, we have to push more and more data faster and faster. And to do that, you have to make the interconnects denser and denser, meaning the electrical parts have to get smaller and smaller. well, reaching a point where that making it smaller is having a negative impact on how it works. We can't go any smaller. So we want to replace electrical interconnect with an optical interconnect. We want to move the data from part to part with light instead of electricity. And that requires many things, and one of them is a way to get light into the chip plane, and you can do that with an optical coupler. That's what I made. We couldn't make it before, or well, it's been made, but not in a way that's as compatible with the way they make the rest of the chips. So I have developed a fabrication process. My research is about how to do something. Mm-hmm. And then I showed it by doing an example.
So what is the goal of the whole fabrication process?
So you can make optical couplers.
Yeah.
They're very small, the ones that we need for these optical interconnects, about 5 microns in height and width. And you can make them, people have made them in different ways, but we want to make them in a way that it is compatible with how you make the rest of the chip, because we want to integrate it into the chip fabrication process. So if you can't make it in a way that's compatible with how they already do things, then even if you come up with a good way to make it, it's not useful for this purpose. And so we want to move towards moving the light around in the chip. So we want to integrate these things. So the purpose is to come up with a way to make optical couplers, which is what's called CMOS compatible. That means it's compatible with the way they make everything else. And it's fast, because everything's done very high speed with chip manufacturing. And it is scalable. So we want to be able to say, we can make it one of them, but we can also use this technology to make a lot, the mass fabrication. And so we want to have all those things to make it useful for this application.
I think your research is it falls into an interesting field where we'll talk to some people and their research can strictly be science. I mean, at the end of the day, it's strictly going to impact the scientific community. But yours falls into an interesting aspect where it has some practical application. And it'll eventually, if it gets picked up, it would impact manufacturing, which means people might see optical chips. So
Yeah, the work from my research group is all that way.
Okay.
Takashima's research group is extremely practical and applied and focused on making things that do things that are useful now, today. For example, the current focus of the group is LiDAR, and you can see how popular LiDAR is because it's a self-driving car. It's right on the horizon. And so everything out of that group is this way. And so, yes, the work that I did is got like an immediate purpose that you can see right away.
Right. And I think for our listeners too, it's hard to, even if you are in the sciences or in research, it can be hard to comprehend just how advanced the current techniques are for making electronic chips. I took a tour of a company who makes the machines that make the chips. And even with my background, it was like borderline magic seeing the things that they are doing to meet this somewhat arbitrary Moore's law, you know, the doubling every...
Yeah, it's insane what they can do now. It's really amazing.
But it is, it's, I mean, and this is something that they constantly kind of railed against, but in reality it is bumping up against physical limitations.
Yeah, so we have to do something different.
Right, and so that's the driving need.
That's the motivation of where my work was coming from, going in a new direction.
Right. So, all right, so let's get into the details of this. Do you want to describe physically what it is that you set out to fabricate?
Okay. So currently, there's not a good way to put a light source in the chip plane. We want to move light around, which will in turn move data around on the chip plane. And how can we do that? How do we get the light down there? Well, I mean, what do we have? We have lasers. And the smallest laser we can make current is a VCSEL. And that process of making the VCSEL is not compatible with the way they make the rest of the chip. So we can't make a VCSEL point kind of in the chip plane and move it around. And we can't make it at the same time as we make the rest of the chip, transistors and all these things. However, we can make a VCSEL on another plane, and we can bring it very close to the chip that we do want to use. And the problem is that now the VCSEL is going to be pointing down. And we need it to point horizontal to move it around with things like waveguides. So the easiest thing you can do is just point it 90 degrees. And that's a simple 45 degree mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And that will turn the beam from the vertical position to the horizontal and allow you to get light into the chip plane. So my goal is to make that beam turning device. You can think of it like a right triangle. It's just a 45 degree mirror that is very small. And so we can, if we get that, that can work together with the waveguide, which can move it once it gets in the chip plane. And we can use another coupler to bring it back out for evaluating. And this forms the basis for a optical interconnect.
Mm. And it's a little bit, the devil's in the details, I guess. It sounds maybe easy to fabricate. Yeah, it's just 45 degree mirror, but that's...
There are many problems with making things. So first of all, I have to use the technology that we use to make chips because I want to make it at the same time as the chip and have it compatible. So we use lithography. Lithography is a process in which you can pattern shapes by using a stencil, or we call it a mask. And so you shoot light through this mask, and the shadow of that projects a pattern onto a material which is sensitive to light. And it's a very small, fine detail pattern, and that then changes the properties of some kind of material, and then you can apply a developer, which is a solution which will remove whatever the light hit and then washes it away, and you're left with the pattern that the mask was shining down. And that's how we make transistors, and that's how all chips are made. It's well established, it's been around for a long time. And so there are two main types of lithography. There's mask-based lithography, which is what I just described, and it's been around. And there's maskless lithography, which does not use a mask, and it's also known as laser direct writing. In this one, you will actually shine a focused laser into some kind of photosensitive material, and you can be more free about it and kind of carve out shapes.
Hmm.
So both of these are really popular for making all sorts of things. And they can also make micro lenses and very small Fresnel lenses and these kind of things. But it's actually very difficult to make what I described, the right angle triangle with either of these technologies. So to make that happen, I combined pieces of either one together to get the best of both worlds.
So you said that the advantage of maskless lithography or direct writing, direct laser writing?
Laser direct writing.
I'll try every option before getting the right one. Is that you get to basically have a lot more freedom in the shape that you're designing.
Yes.
And as I understood it, I could be incorrect, but why don't you just say what's the advantage of mask-based lithography?
Mask-based is really good at making well-defined, sharp edge type structures, like rectangles and waveguides. And it can make them very, very small. hundreds of nanometers.
Right.
It's very accurate. You use these projection lenses to get to minify the mask even smaller than it is. And this is where this whole lithography lens comes into play. And so it's really well established, and it's very, very fast. You can write things like on huge 400 millimeter wafers. I don't know, just like maybe 4 wafers a minute. It's incredibly, and then on each wafer is just hundreds and hundreds of chips. You can write them very, very fast. So it's very fast, and it's very fine detail. And the laser direct writing is very much more flexible, but it cannot do what the mask one does. So it can write in specific locations instead of just projecting the pattern. It doesn't use a mask. So one, I guess, drawback of the mask-based one is that once you want to make something, you have to make a specific mask. And if you want to make something new, you got to make that a new mask. And the masks are very expensive. Right. Mm-hmm. And you have to take them out. And so you can't really, the system is not adaptable. It's very, very good at one thing. And then you have to redo it and make a new mask. And then you have to set it all up. And that takes time. And the laser direct writing is extremely adaptable. It does not use a mask. It modulates the laser based off of a virtual mask. It uses a computer input to tell the laser what to write.
Right.
And so you can make any pattern you want, and it's free to change the pattern. You don't have to pay for another mask. However, it's using a focused laser spot, and that is a Gaussian type shape. So you cannot make hard edges because of the shape of the laser focusing. So you can make round ones really good, like micro lenses, no problem. You can make these kind of things.
Right.
But no well-defined stuff. So if you think about the shape that I want to make, it's in the middle. It's not exactly a rectangle, but it has a hard edge. So it's a right triangle. So it has a pointy edge at the top and a very flat 45-degree slope. So it's not curvy like a lens. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be easy to make with the laser direct writing, but it's not just something you can project because the height changes.
Right.
So it's not something you can project with the mask base. So you can't really make that. Even though it's a simple shape, it's just a triangle. When you want to make something that's 5 microns, you use lithography. So here we are. We want to make something very small. We have 2 technologies to make small things. Neither of them work for this particular thing. And this is a very important thing. So that's where my research started. That's what it's based on.
Okay. So how did you make it?
That's the question.
And before we go on to, we do have some listeners who don't have either a large math background or aren't in optics. When Chris is talking about Gaussian, it might not be intuitive to some people, but the beam of a laser, the intensity, if you took a cross-section of that laser beam, the intensity across it kind of looks like a bell-shaped curve. So right in the center, you can have the highest intensity, the highest power, and at the edges, that really falls off. So. Anyways,
it's not like a pinpoint focus,
right?
Like you can imagine. I mean, it looks like that, but if you are to take a magnified view of the beam, it changes the intensity, like Logan said, as a bell curve, and that prevents you from making hard edges. So the trick is to start with one and finish with the other. Because one is good in the beginning, one is good at the end. The mask aligner is very good at making the rectangles, remember.
Mm-hmm.
So what I discovered was, why don't I make a rectangle? And then I'm not going to finish the process. I'm going to take it over to the other one. And then I'll expose it some more. So let me back up and explain a little bit about the general idea about how we make things with lithography again. The process is you take a silicon or a glass or some kind of substrate, something you want to use to hold up your photosensitive material. We call this photoresist. That material is like a sticky, syrupy consistency, and it's sensitive to light, usually in the UV, 365 nanometers to 405 nanometers. And when you expose the light, and so what you do is you coat this material onto the substrate using a spin coater. You drop some sort of special amount, and then you spin it on a on the substrate, and it spreads out, and it applies a known thickness based on how fast you spin it onto the substrate. That thickness is determined by the speed at which you spin and how fast you slow it down, these kind of things. This is the spin recipe. And so it's a layer on top of this substrate. And then you take that substrate, and using one of the two methods, you expose it. You write the pattern. You put the light in the pattern that which you want to make. And if it's a positive photoresist, there are negative as well. But a positive photoresist means whatever the light hits, it will change some of the attributes of the photoresist, such that when you put it in a solution called a developer, that part will get removed. And then you wash it with the water, and you're left with kind of the opposite of what you shined.
Right.
And that's the basics of how it works. So what I did was I took my sample and I used a positive photoresist, and it got it exposed by the mask aligner, and so it becomes I expose a rectangle shape, and then so it's a hard edge, but I do not develop it. That would have finished the process and left me with a rectangle, and so I just leave it undeveloped. And that point, it's called a latent image. When you have written in it and you've changed the physical properties, but all the material is still there, that's called the latent image of the shape that which you want to write. So then I wrap it back up, put it into foil, because I was actually doing this in another building, because you don't want light to touch it to mess up your exposure. And then you bring it to the other machine, the maskless one, and then you use the laser direct writing system, and you focus the beam. And you can imagine that bell curve. Turn it upside down. That's how the laser is really focused. And I bring kind of the edge of that curvy part of the focus spot right up to the edge of the rectangle. And if you do it just right, it will carve out a perfect 45 degree slope. So you can't make that just by carving out shapes regularly with the laser direct, but if you start to carve out a latent image of a rectangle and you do it just right, it will do that. And that was the trick. That thing, that's what made everything happen. And the reason that works is because the resist has a response to the light. It's not just the more light you put, the more light it gets removed. I mean, it is, but it's not a linear relationship. It's nonlinear. So at some point, more light doesn't really move as much. Mm-hmm. And so there's a nonlinear response to the light. And I'm using a nonlinear piece of the exposure spot. It's at the curvy part of that Gaussian. And those two nonlinear things, that's what allows me to produce a perfect 45 degree slope.
Huh.
I know that's a lot.
So you're combining two nonlinear aspects to achieve.
To make a linear slope. Basically linear,
right, a linear.
Yes, that's the trick.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And if you try to write with the laser direct writing system, the laser spot is about 2 microns. Mm-hmm. And so if you tried to make a 5 micron width, that would be very blocky, right? So I've actually gotten to increase or decrease the feature size of what's possible with that laser by doing this nonlinear trick. Because I'm not just using the focus spot. Right. Like the whole, I'm using just a small piece of it in a certain way. And so that allows me to kind of overcome that. And so I'm writing a 5-micron wide mirror. Mm. And that wasn't possible before.
Huh.
I'll stop now if you have any questions. I know it's a lot. It's hard to understand without pictures.
Well, before we go on, so you said the laser direct writing has, the beam itself is 2 microns?
The beam waist, yeah, the focus spot is that size.
Is there any key issue on control in the laser, except besides a laser waist?
Yes, it is critical to expose in the right place. So you know that I mentioned I'm bringing it from one machine to another. Mm-hmm. And so these are small things. They're very small. The blank that I call it, the one that I wrote on the mask based system but didn't develop, I call that the blank, the mirror blank. And mm-hmm. that piece is 8 micron wide by, I guess it's pretty long, about 1 millimeter. And so you have to bring it perfectly, that the exposure part of the laser has to be perfectly right at the edge of that. You have to have an accuracy of alignment of 1 micron or less. And so getting the alignment was the whole struggle, really. After I figured out the trick on why it happens, making it happen, it was very, very difficult due to alignment.
Huh.
And so I actually developed a new alignment system on how to do that. And that's the only way I was able to make it work. And the alignment and then the amount of laser dose is also critical to how the shape comes out. So you have to get it in the right place, in the right part of the beam, and you have to shine just enough light, but not too much light. It's got to be just right. And the recipe is something I figured out over time.
So why don't you talk about the alignment process? Because this was
yeah, that was really critical. So the machine, which is doing the laser direct writing, is called the MLT. It's the maskless lithography tool. I'll just say MLT from now on. It's a lot shorter than either of those acronyms. The MLT has a stage which has really fine mechanical alignment. And so you can bring it in really close, but you need to be able to check it. So what I did was I wrote into the sample that I had the mirror blank in another place. I wrote an alignment check pattern to make sure it's really happening in the right place. And so I use an alignment camera, which is a camera looking down at the sample with a green light so it doesn't expose the sample. And it's looking, and you do a series of rotations and translations, just like any alignment, to get it where you want it to be. And there's an algorithm which allows you to know if you're in the right ballpark. That was kind of written already into the MLT software. But it didn't always work. And it was not designed to do 1 micron accuracy in any way. That they make things on that machine that were 20, 30 micron accuracy. Right, right. They did not need that level. So to get to that level, I made this check. So I wrote this series of mirror blanks that I wasn't going to use in a different location, these rectangles. And when I brought it over to the maskless, the MLT system, then I would write these special squares. And they would line up with these mirror blanks, which is a series of long stripes, kind of looks like long rectangular stripes, and I would write square exposure patterns in between them in a way such that when I wrote them and I looked at them, I could tell about how far off I'm writing. So I kind of do a pre-write. And the way I made it was similar to a Bernier system, which is kind of like an overlapping marks where they tell you exactly how far you're off from one another. Mm-hmm. I don't know the best way to explain Bernier.
I mean, we can throw up something on with the podcast, like a link or something.
Yeah. So Bernier alignment is a very popular way of making really fine tick marks on translation stages. Mm-hmm. And I use that idea in my mark design. So I made these special alignment marks and I would write them and I could see them without developing because I modified the alignment camera to see the latent image. Hmm. Undeveloped, and that had not been done before, and that allowed me to check to see, I think I'm in the right place, but am I really? And then I do my check, and then I can do that over and over again until I got it just right before writing the sample. And I did not have to take the sample off to check it because it was the actual one I was going to write on. So once I had it, I just wrote the right recipe for the location of the laser right on the mirror blank and put in the power. Huh. And things, and it worked. It was tricky.
Yeah.
How long did this take you?
Forever. I don't know. It took probably a good 4 years to figure out how this is going to happen, how to make this cool thing, and then another year to figure out how to get the alignment perfect, and then maybe another year to measure the thing,
right,
to prove that I did make it.
Yeah, so that's where we've talked about how you were going to, and how you did make this 45 degree mirror, but how did you know you made the 45 degree mirror? Because I recall you sending me a message asking if you could use my deflectometry system.
Oh yeah, so they're really small. You can't just look at them. They're 5 microns, so it's very difficult to measure. But there are technologies for measuring small things, right? We have these kind of things. We have microscopes and such, and I used everything I could find to measure small things.
Wow.
So I'll just go through them and tell you how it didn't work. Because my thing that I wanted to measure was just special. And okay, so it's a 90 degree kind of beam turner. It makes light bend at 90 degrees away from it, so keep that in mind. So I want to measure this thing. I need to know how high it is, how smooth it is, and what's the angle. Those are the main three things. Know if I really made it. So the microscope can't work because it just looks down on it. First of all, it doesn't have the resolution I need, and it just looks straight down, and then if you're looking straight down at a right triangle, it looks like a square,
right
the top down projection,
right.
So I could tell the width, but I can't tell the slope or how smooth it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to help. While I was making it, I was using the scanning electron microscope to refine the recipe and make sure that this slope was looking good. So that's a good way to tell me if I can tell me the slope, because it's a cross section. What you do is you take the sample and you break it in half right where the mirror is, and you look at the cross section of the mirror on the SEM, and you can measure the height, the width, and the angle, and also the slope. So actually that's very promising. And that helped me while I was making it. However, when I made the final sample, I need to not have it broken. So this is a destructive technique.
Right.
So I could not use that on the final one to measure the slope. So that's out. What else do we use? We use interferometers to measure small things. White light interferometer is popular. Unfortunately, how do we use that? We shine light down on something, the light reflects back up, and we can tell something about how smooth it is. can't do that with my sample because it won't reflect any light back up. It will reflect it to the right, 90 degrees. So that won't work.
Right.
And so then there's also profilometry.
Yeah.
Profilometers are these little very small mechanical tips,
yeah,
which you drag across something, and the amount that the tip bounces up and down tells you something about how high the actual step height of something is. That was actually very close to working. I got that. First of all, the tip has to be small enough.
Right.
Because it's a round tip, and if you try to envision my sample, it's a right triangle. So if you bring a circle right up against a 45 degree slope, it's going to be a part where that circle doesn't have the resolution to go in the crevice, and you actually don't get the measurement.
Right.
So if you have a small enough tip radius, which eventually I did find one in another building with a 2.5 micron tip, that should work. You can drag it across it, and it's light enough that it doesn't destroy it, and it should give you a profile of whatever you're measuring. However, it did not work, because when you use profilometry, it is very good for measuring the distance in height from one location to another, but it's not good for actually profiling something, because there is a there is a residual kind of inherent error when you drag something across it. It widens the actual measurement. It's a convolution. I know it's a math term, but basically you're dragging something across, and because there's a circular measuring device, that radius kind of stretches the actual shape of what you're measuring in a sense of a convolution.
Right.
And
right.
So that actually would make, if you can imagine a rectangle, if I'm trying to make a rectangle, the measurement off of a profilometer will give you a trapezoid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very difficult to undo numerically. I could not figure it out.
Right.
That was out. Couldn't do that. And then I went to the extreme, and there's something called an AFM, atomic force microscopy. This is basically like a very extreme profilometer. It uses a tip in the same way, but it's just really much, much smaller. Not microns, but hundreds of nanometers. And you drag that across. That one almost worked. I spent a month learning how to use an AFM, and I was really close. And that one had, unfortunately, the only AFMs I had access to. The way it goes is you're dragging like a needle, and the needle is going up and down depending on when it hits a bump. And the amount that it can go up and down, it just determined by the machine itself and the needle. And the one we had did not go up past 3 microns.
Okay.
So the needle was perfect. I could measure the resolution and not have that trapezoid effect, but it could not measure something that was higher than 3 microns.
Yeah.
Mine was 5.
Mm-hmm.
Lost that technique. So I could not figure out how can I show. I know I made it because I can destroy it and read it on the SEM and make it, but how can I make the final one and not break it? Well, I had to make my own. I made my own measurement station. So the way I did it was I took the sample, and it got a 45 degree slope on there, and I put it on a translation stage which can move all directions, X, Y, Z, and circular. And then I shined a focused laser spot onto it, and I rotated the sample. You can imagine rotating the sample 45 degrees. Then it appears to the laser that it's a flat mirror.
Right.
So when you shine a laser on the sample in its normal orientation, it bends 90 degrees. But if you rotate the sample 45 degrees and then until it's flat to the incoming light. Then you can get light to come back out, mm-hmm. and you can measure the power of that light. And use a beam splitter to siphon off the reflected light, different from the input light. And so you can put in light and then measure the output light and see, while you rotate it, where does the output get the highest power? It's going to get the highest when the surface is flat.
Right.
It's going to reflect the most. Mm-hmm. So when it's flat, whatever your rotation angle is, that's the rotation angle, or that's the angle of the slope of the mirror.
Right.
That allowed me to measure the slope. That was the final trick that worked. It was hard.
Yeah.
And now I don't just have a mirror on there. I also made a waveguide of it.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to make a whole device. So there's right. a waveguide on there, and making that was another year. That was different. And so once you make it together and you verify the angle, this same setup, I had multiple different pieces. It could also bring light in, mm-hmm. couple light into the waveguide by bouncing it off that slope and out and measure it, and I could show that it was working.
Wow.
And so not only could I measure it, but I could test the device and make it work with my test setup that I built.
So,
I know, it's a lot.
First of all, what I find interesting is that you described, you know, like three or four sub, essentially master's theses, if not yeah. if not PhD dissertations amongst your work, which is kind of
it's a real pain,
insane, yeah. But you know, you have to make your thing work, I guess, which is
yeah. What's the point?
Right,
got to make sure.
But I do want to talk about that in the sense of, so you fabricated your 45 degree mirror. You made
alignment system.
You made an alignment system. You figured out a test method.
Yeah.
You tested it. You knew it was 45 degrees. You then made this along with a waveguide, and you tested it, and you shine. So you shine a beam in, and you test it. Can you talk about how did you test it, and do you mind touching on the fact that at this scale, at this micron or very, very small scale, optics stops being necessarily linear. We can't use this ray approximation where you say, like, oh, here's a beam of light and it hits it, and you get a lot of odd nonlinear effects like diffraction. So can you maybe talk about that if you ran into anything like that?
Kind of, yeah. So when you are evaluating waveguides, you have this idea of a waveguide working like a fiber optic, using the TIR, the total internal reflection, by bending light, bouncing it around at certain angles, up and down through this tube and coming out and being confined. But really, you got to think about it like you're supporting a light mode inside the waveguide, and so that is a little tricky. And so we did simulations to kind of understand what waveguide shape would work, and so you're sending in a Gaussian beam and you're getting one out. So when I was testing it, what happens was you're focusing a light, and it's an invisible light, which makes it harder. The waveguide and mirror was designed to work with 1550 nanometers infrared. That's what's common for these optical interconnects. And so in my setup, I can't see any of the light going on, so aligning it was another beast. You put it in, you measure the light right before you go into the whole device, and then you measure it on the out.
Right.
And you just see, you know, what's the ratio. And then you have to start thinking about, well, is this really the number that I'm reflecting? Because there are many little things that will take your light away. And you have to account for all of those things. So when I first got my measurement and the light out, I was very excited. On the camera, you can see the spot, and it's a perfect calcium. Really? Beautiful. Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah, the fit to the curve is amazing. And but if I when I took the measurement of the actual number, it was like a 20 dB of loss, which is like 1% efficiency. It was very, very high loss. And I was very sad. And I did not know why what was going on. And this was after I got it. That was the best I got it. It actually was much worse the first time. And there's all this loss. And I thought, well, I know it's working, but it's so bad. Why is it so bad? So you can't... I couldn't just take that number and say, that's how good my coupler works.
Right.
I actually had to think about, well, how do I know the coupler itself? Because I'm testing a whole device. Mm-hmm. I actually have a coupler on top of a cladding layer, which is on top of a substrate.
Right.
And there's a upper cladding on top of all of that. So the light is going in. There's Fresnel reflections at the surface, at every interface. When it goes in, there's Fresnel reflection when it goes into the waveguide, and when it goes out. So there's three Fresnel reflections. You're lossing.
And that, for listeners, Fresnel reflection just means that you're getting light bouncing back, basically.
Yeah, you're not getting all of it to go in.
Right.
So you're losing some. And so there's that loss, and then there's the waveguide itself. Maybe it's not the perfect tube to travel the light through. There's loss in the waveguide. Mm-hmm. So I had to actually make a separate waveguide exactly like the one I was testing, measure the loss of that. I didn't know how to do any of this, by the way. So I learned that kind of on the job. So I had to measure the waveguide loss by itself. Okay, you can subtract that off. And then you have to think about the reflectivity.
Yep.
Okay, so the mirror, it's made out of the photoresist, but it's you got to put something shiny on it to make it a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gold coated, and so that gold has a certain reflectivity. How much gets reflected when you put it in? So I figured out that it should be 99%, but mine was 95 for some reason or another. Lose some things there. So there's these and other things that contributed to these huge amount of loss. And so I had to kind of take another, this took another 2 months to figure out what's going on. After you know that it works, then you tested it, but then you didn't have the numbers you expected. So then you have to think about what's all the possibilities. And so when it came down to it, at the end, after compensating for everything, the coupler is about 5 dB of loss, which is comparable to other current state-of-the-art couplers. It could be better. There's other things that can be done, but I was happy when I figured that out.
Yeah, not 20 dB.
So it was a big struggle, but that once we got that number, that was pretty much it. We figured out it does work. It works okay. So.
And then you defend it, and you
I published the paper, and they liked it and they accepted it, and then I defended. Yes.
Huh. So to recap real quick, you initially were presented with this research project, which Intel?
So Intel funded it.
Initially funded it. They said, we want an optical interconnect, and that means that they want to be able to put light onto a chip and use a waveguide to optically transfer that light, and you need to get it on and off the chip, which is where the 45...
Well, they were just interested in figuring out how to make a 45-degree slope. They had done that before. And so once I figured out the kind of starting of the idea, then they left.
Okay.
And they yeah, I figured out the first year with him, and then we were going to the next phase and figuring out how to put it with the waveguide and make the rest of the thing, and we were taking too long, and they said, see ya, thanks for figuring that first part out. And then they left, and I lost that funding. Another story, but so then I did another project at the same time to get funding. That's another project. So then after I lost them, I continued the project by myself to figure out how to make the full interconnect.
And you made the interconnect. This is impressive. It's a lot just to remember. So you devise a fabrication method. You're going to use initially a mask-based lithography. You're going to make a rectangle. You're going to combine this and follow it up with maskless lithography and use the Gaussian nature of your beam.
And the custom alignment procedure.
And you made a custom alignment procedure. You managed to etch a 45-degree mirror, 5-micron width.
Yes, and at the same time as making a waveguide.
Right, simultaneously making a waveguide.
And then you have to figure out how to coat the gold on only the mirror.
Which we didn't talk about, which I...
Which is another thing I had to figure out.
But for the sake of time, you figured that out. And I want our listeners also to keep in mind, this is during graduate school. This is, again, we do have to eat. We do need money. So that means that you were TAing. Ten times you TA'd in the midst of this. You figured out how to do this. You did it. You made the 45-degree mirror. You coded it. You did this all simultaneously with making A, that hadn't been done. B, you did it simultaneously with making a waveguide.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you proved that it was 45 degrees. You shine your light down onto the interconnect, the mirror. It bounces into the waveguide, hits another 45-degree mirror at the other side, bounces out.
Well, I didn't have the second mirror. I just measured out of one waveguide.
So you got
it
out.
Yeah.
And we talked about modes. If you don't have a strong background in math or you're not really inclined to this, a somewhat simple way to think about it, and it's not necessarily really super accurate, but if you think musically, if you make a note, let's say a G note, and you pass it through a tunnel, like someone plays a G note on one side and someone hears it on the other side after passing through, you want it to still be a G note. You don't want the note to change. That's loose. It's not really accurate, but for slapdash purposes, I think it's okay. It's in reality, it's a 3D
thing
mode. Yeah. But anyways, so you got it out, you measured it. This takes a long time. This is a number of projects strung together in reality to basically prove and make a new complete manufacturing technique. And you're done. And you finished. So, first of all, congrats.
Thanks.
In the scope of graduate projects that I've ever heard, that's definitely one of the most
ridiculous.
Ridiculous is one way to describe it, and impressive, sure. When I listened to your defense, it was just like absolutely insane. I think everyone in the audience thought that. Insanely impressive, I should say. Insane and insanely impressive.
Yeah.
So I think that covers the real research portion of this interview. But what I want to talk about now is, what was your graduate experience like? How was the actual process of grad school?
Yeah, I think you must have a really different point of view on this.
Yes.
Because of the experience.
Well, and also, I'd love for you to share some of your advice for those people who are already in grad school. If you're already in grad school and you're working on your dissertation, I've personally found Chris's advice to be kind of invaluable. So,
if you're not already in grad school, do it.
So... grad school, what was it like if you were going to meet someone who's an undergrad and they're saying, man, I don't know if I want to go to grad school.
Should I go yeah. or not.
Yeah. Probably not.
But maybe meanwhile, they don't know how to, they don't want to get a job or whatever.
Yeah, get a master's, I guess. Master's is, I think, a great sweet spot. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very useful thing for industry, but I don't see really, the PhD is maybe not necessary for most things. But for the sake of people that are already in grad school, yeah, too late for you. I'll maybe give some advice. Yeah, it was a beast. It's really a beast to get out and to really finish. There's so many steps that you just take for granted that, okay, I just got to do this. And then, no, there's so many things. Mm-hmm. And so you can do some preparation to help you get out faster. Start writing. Just start writing as soon as you can. As soon as you can. Because that took so much longer than I thought it ever would. And what's really, really the worst part of writing is you have to figure out what your work is and where it stands and what's the context. And you need to go and see what everyone else did. And this is not something we always do. And I didn't get to do it this way. Theoretically, before you begin work, you should do a nice literature search and see, what's everyone else doing? How can I do something someone else hasn't done before? I didn't get that chance. I just was given a problem by the company and assumed that no one had done it before. Turned out no one had. But I had to go back my last 6 months and figure all this out. When if I had done this a couple years before, it would have been much easier. So find your resource. References. Find all the references. Use some kind of reference manager like Zotero or Mendeley, one of these free ones. RefWorks is free through the college, but then after you graduate, you don't get it anymore. I like Zotero because it's free forever.
Yeah, and it has a nice Word plugin.
Oh, yeah, and you have to use Firefox, though.
Yeah.
But it's really good, so definitely get a huge collection. Just slowly begin reading about stuff in your field. Know what people did, because you really can't get a sense of why what you're doing is important until you know what everyone did already. And I just didn't do this until the last minute. That would have been much easier. When you write your dissertation, you will have to write the introduction. That is the hardest part. That is basically 10 pages on what I just described, and those 10 pages take the longest. And so if you do that early on, then it will really save you a lot of time. It'll help you write your papers. Mm-hmm. You'll need that for your papers. Definitely get the background of your work and understand your place. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Start making figures. You're going to need them for your presentations, for your PowerPoints. You're going to need them for your papers and your thesis. You just start drawing. You need to have a collection. So start making, like what I did was I made a single PowerPoint file with all my figures. They don't have to be made in PowerPoint, but they can be stored there. Yeah. And I did make a lot of them in PowerPoint. PowerPoint is really good for making pictures, actually, more than just PowerPoint presentations. So make figures and store them throughout your career. Start putting them together, because that takes a really long time. And when you have to have them and you don't, it sucks. So.
We talked to Dr. Christine Bradley a little bit ago, yeah. And she was describing writing her dissertation. She said basically she didn't have figures built up, so she had to start every morning for a number of months. The morning period was making figures.
Yeah, then you got to make them good. You can't just make some trash.
Isn't that the truth?
You got to be very careful and make them exact. And this is like the top level of research. Mm-hmm. You gotta make them good. And so that takes time. Get good at something like PowerPoint. It can make a lot. You can also use SketchUp. This is what I ended up using. It's free software from Google for 3D modeling, but it's very basic. If you don't want to spend time learning SolidWorks, or you don't know SolidWorks, which is probably not that hard, I haven't learned it, but I want to, but I heard it's not that bad, but this is really, really fast. SketchUp can make nice 3D models. You can learn it in a day. And they have great tutorials. Oh, so that was
very helpful. I'll make a link for Zotero and SketchUp. I use Inkscape instead.
I heard that was very popular too.
Instead of PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Teach their own, really.
Inkscape will be great, but for 3D models, SketchUp will be very, very fast. Be clear with your advisor. Make it very clear what you want and what you need, because they don't always know, and they may just keep going with things even if you need to not. So you need to be very, very clear about what you want to do with your work, when you want to get out, how you want to get out, how you can get out, what they need from you. Have lots of discussions. Be clear about funding. Be certain that you will get funded. Start talking the semester before you need funding about that semester's funding.
Or longer before.
Yeah, make sure that you know at least a year of funding in advance to know how it's the path to how that's going to happen. Because that gives them time to plan and they know that you're serious about that. Mm-hmm. Be clear, put your foot down, and don't be afraid to ask for what you need. That can speed things along. Be very direct and assertive. Sometimes professors tend to kind of talk over you or decide things for you. And if you don't speak up and say things, you will get things decided for you, and you may be here longer than you expect or want. But you have to say that. You have to put your foot down. Or sometimes things will never happen.
I think that's a hard process.
It is hard.
To kind of come to terms with. You know, you start graduate school and you are not necessarily particularly skilled. Maybe some people are, but in the field that you joined. And you joined a lab and you're now going to be on some very hard technical project and you're learning and getting guidance from either older graduate students or your advisor. And at some point, the goal, Dr. Norwood phrases best, his goal, he stated, was that he wants you to come in, and by the end of it, he wants you to basically usurp his role. He wants you to be the leader of that topic, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's really hard to advocate for yourself, where you come in and you're the one who's learning, and by the end of it, you should be the one who's saying, like, I know the topic, I know when it's ready, et cetera, et cetera. You're the one defining it. And Jung, you and I know I've been really fortunate with Daewook. Daewook, if you're listening, you know.
Yeah.
he's been really good, but, you know, we've been really fortunate in that you don't have to worry about funding. There are no real big surprises. He's pretty clear at the onset of, or you work with him at the onset and say, this is my plan, this is how much I'm supposed to do to graduate. If you, like you say, I know you you might want to talk about this more, but you can really get shafted as a grad student.
Big shaft.
Yeah.
No loop.
Yeah. If you don't define this clearly for listeners, or if you're new to grad school or thinking about grad school, make no mistake about it. It might not be malicious, but you can find yourself in a situation where
kind of awkward.
I would go worse than kind of awkward. I would say that you don't have power over your situation. If your goal is to graduate with whatever degree you set out for, and you're now, your time, your money, and what in effect is, therefore, your life.
Putting
is,
on hold. You get put on hold.
It's put on hold, and it's determined by someone else. So
that's one thing in grad school you have to learn. It's never talked about and never mentioned. You got to become an independent person. And your advisor becomes closer to a colleague as you get closer to finishing. And so he becomes less of your advisor, more of a boss. Mm-hmm. And you have to become that independent person to say what you need as a job. And that's just how it is. So be careful. Just, okay, so let's see. a lot of what I've been saying is kind of PhD oriented. But as I mentioned before, I got my master's in a completely different story. And I will say that you're in charge of your education. You can get more or less out of your time. And when I got my master's, I will admit that my quality of the degree, I let slip. And it was not good enough for me to go into the industry I wanted to. And that was one reason I came back for PhD. One reason that the quality was low is because I had an advisor that was very, very hands-off, and so it was up to me, and that's dangerous because I'm a lazy kind of guy. I know the dangers of that now, but before I didn't. And I basically did not take the coursework or gain the skills in the shorter amount of time required for master's, 2 or 3 years. You got to be real careful because you've only got a short time, and you got to make it count. So if you're a master's student, you got to make sure you take coursework that's relevant, something that's going to help you with your career. For example, I took all the theoretical PhD classes, although those are very nice to know things that most people in the world will never know, they didn't help me when I got asked, how do you make a beam expander in the interview?
Or, right.
You know, how do you align the laser? Practical things. Mm-hmm. So make sure you take classes and get skills and learn from people in a way that helps you go forward once you're done with your short time during your master's. That's really important.
Do you, so beyond that advice, do you want to share your hobbies that you had during school that helped you? I mean, I think this is serious, but that you had during school that helped you kind of like balance or have some fun during grad school. I know we've talked to some people, and some people say they do yoga. Some people say that they hike a lot.
Oh yeah, so I'll start with hiking. Hiking is critical. yeah, it was critical. Grad school is dangerous. Probably no one said that yet.
We actually have. Chase, yeah. Salisbury,
it's dangerous to your psyche, to your mental health, your physical health. It can be really rough, and a lot of people get very depressed. Many people get this imposter syndrome. I don't know if you've talked about that.
No.
Have you heard about it? Do you know what it is?
I have, but please.
Yeah. So basically, people get the idea that they're not good enough, that they don't know enough, or they're not worthy, and people think that why do I deserve to be in grad school? Or I'm not anywhere near as smart as everyone around me, and they feel like an imposter. They feel like they can't do it, and that they're just not worth it. Because you see, you're surrounded by really, a lot of smart people, but you gotta remember you're smart to get there in the first place. And the problem is, and why this happens is, what maybe people don't talk about is academia and science in general. It's a bunch of failure. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's a bunch of failing until you get it right. Because research is about discovering something new and something that has never been done before, it's really hard, and it requires lots of failed attempts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you have to live with that. You have to be able to pick yourself up and say, let's try again. Mm-hmm. I tried again over and over thousands of times, and I got my optimism really left. And so that can lead to this depression, and it's very dangerous. And so one way to battle this is to talk to other people, because you need to hear that other people are going through this first.
Yeah, and be candid about it.
It's easy to think that it's just you, but talk to other grad students. I guarantee you everyone else is struggling, because this is rough. Another thing is to go hiking, because the nature is, I think last year a journal article came out where they were able to prove the correlation between improved mental state and hiking. And they put a number to it, at least 30 minutes before you can actually get that feeling. And it will help your brain and help you feel better emotionally, mentally, and physically, get in shape. But the nature, something about just being out there and just seeing the world, it really, really helps. So I went hiking a lot, so I would highly recommend hiking. But other than that, also finding something you like to do that's different than what you do in the lab.
Yeah.
It really helps. I'm a photographer. That was a twofold for me. I got lucky on that one. That hobby kind of took off, and it really was very life-saving for me. It helped me to have an artistic outlet throughout all this logic that you experienced during the grad school, and it helps creatively to free your mind, and that is helpful in research. You need to be creative. How else will you come up with new ideas that no one has done before? It's more than just knowing the math and knowing the physics. You need to be thinking outside the box and thinking in new and different ways. And if you have a hobby or an outlet which is creative, that kind of ignites that in your brain, and that'll help you. Fortunately, my creative outlet was also my way of getting paid. Because I got really into photography and, like, really into it. And I began being a photographer and actually photographing people for money. And that supplemented my grad school income, because I didn't always get full funding. And so being a photographer helped me. I would do weddings on the side, and portraits, and sell landscape prints and these kind of things. You don't have to make money from your hobby. That was just a bonus. But you should find something that allows you to be creative. It will help you in the lab, even though it sounds non-intuitive.
No, yeah, I think that can't really be overstated. You know, I personally play, I started playing music, and that... when it clicks, I mean, as listeners probably know, I like running a lot, or I like hiking, but for music as a creative outlet, when it clicks, that feeling of, like, relief.
Yeah, you need to let your brain turn off from the grad school.
Yeah.
Take breaks. Take a day off. You can't work forever. I made that mistake. I worked too much because I thought, it's almost there. I'll just keep working. Almost there. Just keep going. And it sounds like it will work. It sounds like a good idea, because you just want to say, I'm going to push myself until it's done. And you want to finish. But the problem is, the more that you're pushing yourself over the limit, the less your brain is working well.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the diminishing returns. And you get exhausted mentally, and you actually become less efficient and get less done, and you're putting more work in, and so you're only hurting yourself. You're not getting more research done, and you're putting so much stress on your brain and your body.
Yeah.
Take breaks. I know it's difficult. I know it is. The way that we are taught and the culture of the academia tells us not to. You have to. You have to take days off, because you will not be successful, and you'll just kill yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, don't try to rush through it. It's gonna end when it's gonna end.
Yeah, it will. And don't be afraid to walk away.
Yeah,
I'm gonna say that I should have walked away. I definitely don't need a PhD. I'll tell you that much.
Well.
I don't. I should have walked away about 3 years ago. Master's would have been great for me. I want to be in industry. Unless you want to be in academia or something that specifically needs a PhD. Then you try your best to finish, but if something gets overwhelming, just stop. Mm-hmm. You'll be fine. You have learned many things up to that point. You cannot be taken away, the knowledge that you have. even if you do not have a degree to show for it, a master's or a PhD, you still have a knowledge and you have an experience, and that can't be taken away. Yeah. Even if you walk away, that can be the best. Don't be afraid to do that. It may be the best thing you make. So,
and I would add, don't define yourself based on an arbitrary title.
Oh, there's so many more things besides the degree.
Well, and this is something that's really kind of disenfranchised me a lot recently, is listeners might be saying, oh, well, an arbitrary title, you know, if you get a master's, I know that you had to do X to get a master's, or, oh, if you got a PhD, I know that you had to do Y to get a PhD. And that's, if you want to, I guess we're really talking too many unpleasant realities, but if you want an additional unpleasant reality, that is, that's not the case. I've seen people who have done an enormous amount of work in terms of research, in terms of course load, and they've gotten a master's, or Chris, in your case, I mean, you've done something that's almost unbelievable, and you've gotten a PhD. I've also, on the other hand, seen people who kind of didn't, who came in and they did some work, they did the coursework, and they got a master's, or did some simulations, and they got a PhD.
Yeah, it's actually different. Depends on which topic are you working on.
Yeah. The person.
Yeah,
it depends on the person. But I've spoken to people who did stop a PhD to get a master's and really kind of beat themselves up for at least a little bit and think until the sheer happiness of not being in school kicked in. But at least a little bit, there is a big struggle of like, man, am I not as good of a person or a scientist because I don't have this title? No. Just because you have a title, it doesn't mean that you did, it doesn't mean you did the same amount of work as anyone else. You know, just keep that in mind for listeners or you know.
But I have to say, it depends on which country are you from. Yeah, because this is going to be totally different in China.
Yeah.
How do you... It's like certain company and definitely the university and certain laboratory, you have to get a PhD. Then you can go there. Otherwise, you can never go in there.
I guess so it depends on what you want to do.
Yeah.
So where you want to go.
Yeah, so.
But there can be many things that you don't need it for. It just depends. But don't think that it's the only way.
Yeah, because I think you definitely, if you know, okay, that is my final goal, you got lots of way to go there instead of only one way.
Yeah. And like you're saying, it might not apply in China or in...
Yeah, but still, it's like you do not have to stay. Oh my God. You do not have to always stay in China. And, and meanwhile, you do not, like, there are lots of ways to, I mean, you actually want to just do that thing instead of, okay, I want to stay in that company. You just want to do that thing. You can definitely find other company allows you to do that. Where other society, others, what is that? Community allows you to do that.
Yeah. And again, like Chris said, advocate for yourself. If you find yourself in the midst of some program and you know, thought that you might have wanted to go into a company that you think requires a PhD or maybe become a professor, but you find that you just hate the environment or find it toxic,
then maybe not.
Yeah, figure out for yourself. It might not be the right course, and it's okay to change courses. But again, easier said than done, perhaps.
Yeah, but it can be. And talk to people. Other people will help you. Talk to the associate dean if you need to, or other students or other professors. Just get other perspectives. You never know how someone could have gone through exactly what you went through, and they have some ideas.
Yeah. Right.
And hike.
Definitely hike. Yeah, you should definitely go hike.
So, okay, well, do you have any thoughts?
As always, thank you for listening to this week's episode. We look forward to any comments or feedback you may have. To leave a comment, please visit our website at loft.optics.arizona.edu/podcast or our Facebook, which is SPL Report. Additionally, you can email us at thespotlightreport@gmail.com. Lastly, we would like to mention that we are always looking for new topics or people to interview. So if you have a topic that you would like us to cover, please let us know. Thank you and have a good week.